Probably most of us try to be as positive as we can, and we like to say yes every time we have the opportunity, but there are times when it's important to be able to say no. And in regard to the things of the Lord, I think all of us would agree that we'd like to have a stronger ability to say no whenever that is necessary. Titus chapter 2, beginning of verse 11, Paul spoke about the grace of God when he said that the grace of God that brings salvation has appeared to all men, teaching us that denying, that's saying no, denying ungodliness and worldly lusts, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in the present age. We obviously have the ability, don't we, to choose what we will do when we are faced with a set of circumstances. We have the ability to, as free moral agents, to say yes or to say no. And God gave us that ability. And yet, as I say, we all, I think, would agree that we're not able to say that as consistently as we ought to. And so we want to think a little while this evening about the ability to resist temptation. That is to say no to things that God's grace would teach us to deny, things that ought to be rejected. I want to begin by saying that while willpower is very, very important, that alone can only carry us so far. We need really to have more willpower than we sometimes do. Great good things come from the ability to be decisive and to determine what we're going to do and what we're not going to do. I've always been impressed in Daniel chapter 1 and verse 8 when Daniel was tempted, undergoing the training regimen that the king of Babylon had proposed, that he would have been required to eat some things that would have been unclean for him as a Jewish man, and said he purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the king's delicacies. He didn't just think it would be a good idea to say no to those things. He committed himself to do that, and that would have taken willpower. So sometimes we're not decisive enough. But sin is a very attractive power. By attractive, I mean it has the ability to attract us to it, to pull our attention in its direction, and it has a very powerful ability to do that. And if all we can bring to the rejection of sin is just the brute force of willpower, as important as that is, if that's all we have, I'm afraid we're going to fail, because that alone is not enough to say no consistently. We need to recognize the power of positive emotion to go along with our willpower. In a battle between the heart and the head, the heart is almost always going to win. Have you observed that to be the case? When you're battling between something that you really want to do and something that you think you ought to do, if it comes down to that battle between the heart and the head, very often the heart is going to win. I was talking to an elder in a congregation not too long ago about the matter of the importance of marrying a faithful Christian. And he had made what I think was a very unfortunate statement in the presence of some other young people when he had said that he came down to a choice between marrying a very weak member of the Church of Christ and marrying a person whom he said really loves the Lord, but they happen to be a member of a denominational organization. He'd recommend that the young person marry the devoted person of the denominational group. And when I had a chance to talk with him about that afterwards, I said, it hurt me to hear you say that, to recommend that as a choice, as if those were the only two alternatives. I said, if those were the only two alternatives, my recommendation would be just not to get married at all. And he said, well, Gary, that might be good theoretical advice, but he said nobody in the real world is going to do that. Most people want to get married, and that's what they're going to do. And I just said, well, you might be right statistically, but I said, I believe I know some people who love the Lord enough to do what's right, no matter how difficult it might be. But he's certainly correct if he's simply talking about what most people are going to do. It's a choice between what you want to do and what you just theoretically think ought to be done. Your heart's probably going to win. Most people are going to yield to what they would like to do. We talked about that a little bit this morning in our study back in the back in the Song of Solomon, that very familiar statement in chapter 2 and verse 7 of the Song of Solomon, where it says, "I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases." The caution there is that love is a tremendously powerful force. And once it is awakened, once that train leaves the station, it's almost impossible to stop it. And so be careful before you let that train get out of the station. Love and all matters of the heart do have a very great power about them. And so we need to understand how powerful that want to part of us is. I'm afraid we almost take it for granted that our emotions are going to lead us in the wrong direction. I hear people say, you know, when you're making a decision, any kind of decision, you don't ever want to make it on the basis of emotion. You want to set emotion aside and just think rationally what's the best thing to do, as if we're all going to be Mr. Spock, you know, and not have any emotions, and that emotions to be disregarded, that's going to mislead you. So think coldly and rationally about things. Well, I disagree with that. I think that's a false dilemma. God happened to give us a three-part mind. He gave us an intellect, He gave us emotions, and He gave us a will. And I believe our emotions are just as much a part of our thinking apparatus as our intellect and our will. Sometimes our emotions can mislead us, but I'm going to tell you, sometimes our intellect can mislead us too. You notice that? The fact is, we have all three of those parts of our mind, and we shouldn't even want to be pure reasoning machines, as if that alone would indicate the right path to follow. Have you considered the possibility? I think there's a possibility that a lot of people haven't even considered. The possibility of enlisting your emotions in the cause of doing what's right. That is an option. To learn how to bring the power of positive emotion to support us in doing what is right rather than leading us the wrong direction. There's a great danger, I think, in de-emphasizing emotion as if it were always going to mislead us. Certainly in the religious world at large, many people make the mistake of just simply determining what is right based on what they want to do, as if that's all that they needed to consider. And they presume that as long as they're sincere about what they do, that's bound to be acceptable to God. And unfortunately, in a lot of religious circles, whatever commitments people make to the Lord, they very often make those under the influence of some very powerful emotional preaching that stirs people into an emotional state and then gets them to make their commitment under the force of those very strong emotions. And you know as well as I do that commitment doesn't last any longer than those emotions do. Once those emotions die down, then you don't hear any more about that commitment. So we've rightly taught against the dangers and the abuses of emotion. But we may have gone to the opposite extreme, and that is to have de-emphasized emotion to the extent that many of us have tried to serve the Lord without the help of our emotions, as if that could just be left out of the picture. We may have all but eliminated feeling from our service to God. We've reduced religion, I'm afraid in the case of many of us, we've reduced religion to purely a matter of rational argument and raw willpower. Just intellect and willpower is all that we think is needed. And if that's true, then is it any wonder that so many Christians are falling to the power of temptation, that we're not able to say no as often as we'd like to? I believe the fact is that intellect and willpower alone, unaided by emotion, are no match for the devil. You leave your emotions out of your fight against the devil, you're going to lose. The prevalence of sin among us today, I'm afraid even among gospel preachers, is evidence of the limitations of this purely intellectual approach to religion that we have decided to take, as if it's just a matter of the head and never a matter of the heart. We're paying a heavy price for having diminished the rightful role of positive feeling and emotion in our relationship to the Lord. Look, you can't leave out one third of the mind that God gave you and expect to succeed fighting the forces of evil. The devil fights against the whole person, your intellect, your emotions, and your will. And if you don't bring all three of those to bear in the service of what's right, you're probably going to be a casualty on the battlefield. So we need to talk about bringing feeling back into our godliness. And by that I mean your relationship with the Lord, your effort to serve Him and to be faithful. The Scriptures emphasize that the primary motivation to resist temptation has as much to do with the heart as it does the head. And we just can't afford to leave that out. Romans chapter 6 and verse 17, Paul talks about having obeyed from the heart that form of teaching. God be thanked that though you were the slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered. 1 John chapter 3 and verse 3, John makes what I think is a very important statement in regard to being able to say no, when he says, everyone who has this hope in him purifies himself just as he is pure. What is it that would cause you to purify yourself? We can think of purifying ourselves as saying no to any of the stuff that we need to get out of our lives so that what's left is pure. What causes you to reject all the impure stuff? What does he say here? He who has this hope in him purifies himself. It's the positive hope of what you do want to have that will cause you to say no to anything that's inconsistent with that. The stronger your positive hope is, and hope involves a very strong element of feeling, doesn't it? The stronger your hope is, the better able you'll be to say no and to purify yourself. And then, of course, in our text, Titus chapter 2, verses 11 and 12, what did Paul say about the grace of God having appeared? It teaches us to deny ungodliness. Grace is a wonderfully positive subject, but grace teaches you to say no. It teaches you to deny ungodliness, and the gracious goodness of God, as positive as the thing of, as that is, that's the primary key to having the strength to say no. It's not merely the rational understanding of God's law that keeps us doing what's right. It's the heartfelt appreciation for God's grace that will enable you to be strong enough to do that. That principle is well illustrated in the story that we talked about this morning in Luke chapter 7, beginning in verse 36, where Jesus was in the home of Simon the Pharisee. A very sinful woman in that community was anointing the Lord's feet, washing his feet with her tears. And Simon the self-righteous Pharisee was indignant about that. And in his comments to Simon, Jesus pointed out that her great love for him was motivated by the fact that she was deeply conscious of how sinful she really was. And her overflow of love was an outpouring of gratitude on her part. You wouldn't have to preach a very strong sermon to that woman to learn how to live a pure life. Once she came to know the Lord out of positive love for Him, gratitude for His grace, she would have been glad then to start saying no to things that were inconsistent with that love. Simon would have had a hard time understanding that. His self-righteousness and his pride, his foolish thought that he was doing pretty good on his own, he'd have had a much harder time than she would resisting temptation. He probably had as much willpower as she did, but she had a much more powerful thing than willpower, and that is she had a great deal of love and affection for the Lord himself. Let's go back to 1 Corinthians 15, where we were this morning, where Paul is commenting on his own motivation. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 9, he says, I am the least of the apostles, and I am not worthy to be called an apostle, because I persecuted the church of God. But by the grace of God I am what I am, and his grace toward me was not in vain. But I labored more abundantly than they all, yet not I, but the grace of God which was with me. Paul, a strong character, a man who, if ever you read about anybody in the New Testament who had strength about him, it was Paul. But what was the key to his strength? Was it just pure willpower alone? Well, I think you see in this verse the warm, affectionate love and gratitude that he had for God. That's what would have made Paul deny ungodliness, say no to whatever needed to be said no to. He mentioned the same thing over in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, 2 Corinthians 5 at verse 14, when he says, the love of Christ constrains us. That's the compelling force that moves him forward and keeps him saying no to anything that's inconsistent with his hope. The love of Christ constrains us, because we judge thus that if one died for all, then all died, and he died for all. That those who live should live no longer for themselves, but for him who died for them and rose again. You see the power in learning to think that way? Appreciation, deep appreciation for the grace that was shown at the cross, and in the positive affection and gratitude for all of that, you do what you ought to do and you deny things that you ought not to do. That's much more powerful than just raw intellect and willpower alone. Those things we talked about this morning, they flow in a very natural sequence, don't they? When we truly humble ourselves before God, we're genuinely aware of how empty and how helpless we are before God, and then we throw ourselves upon His mercy in genuine penitence, seeking the forgiveness of our sins. And we receive the forgiveness of our sins on His terms, and we accept the reality that He has forgiven us, then that begins a life of gratitude for that. And that begets a deep love. The more grateful you are, the more that you will love God, amazed at the very fact that He could possibly love us. But He does, and so in gratitude for that, we love Him back, and that then produces a seriously devoted life. Obedience and lifelong service. But you have to have all of those in the chain, don't you? Each of those leads to the thing that's next in the chain. Humility, receiving God's forgiveness, gratitude, love, and then a life that does what it ought to do and says no to the things that should be rejected. How many passages could you think about? There are many of them that would point to love as the primary ingredient in our relationship to the Lord. Think about several of them. You'd start with Matthew 22, wouldn't you, where Jesus was asked what was the most important commandment in the law, and which one was it? Well, he went right back to Deuteronomy, where it was said, you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart and your soul and your mind. That was Jesus' answer to the question. That's the heart of the matter. John chapter 14 and verse 15, he taught that if you love me, you will keep my commandments. That's how you have the power to do what you ought to do. It's love. Romans chapter 13, Paul says, love is the fulfillment of the law. It doesn't mean that love is the only commandment, but if you love the Lord as you ought to, it's not just a matter of the will, it's also a matter of our affections, then you'll want to do the other things. Romans 13, verse 8, owe no one anything except to love one another, for he who loves one another, He who loves another has fulfilled the law. And verse 10, love does no harm to a neighbor, therefore love is the fulfillment of the law. 1 Corinthians 13, he will say that nothing we do matters if we don't have love. If that's not the motivating force, then we're wasting our time doing whatever we do. 1 Timothy chapter 1 and verse 5, Paul says that among other things, the goal or the purpose of our teaching is love from a pure heart, a sincere faith, and so forth. That's really what we're after in all of our teaching and all of our work, is to generate a stronger love for the Lord and for one another. Back to 1 Corinthians 13, verse 13, he says of these three great things, love, hope, and faith, which one is the greatest? Love is the greatest of the three. Hebrews 10, verse 24, the Hebrew writer talked about the importance of love in our mutual encouragement of one another. Let us consider one another to stir up what? Love and good works. You see how basic love is? 1 John chapter 5 and verse 3, John says that we love the Lord, His commandments won't be burdensome. You'll delight to do whatever the Lord's will is. For this is the love of God, that we keep His commandments, and His commandments are not burdensome. They would be burdensome if you didn't do it out of love, wouldn't they? Many of those things would be very difficult, if not impossible, if they weren't motivated by love. And then in 2 Corinthians 5, where we were just a minute ago, Paul says that the constraining or the compelling force in his life was the love of Christ. Don't think he just meant there the love that Christ has for us, though that's very motivating, but also our love for him in return. Well, all of those passages and many others that you could think of make the point that love is the primary ingredient in our relationship to the Lord. Now, it is obvious, if you've ever studied the Bible, that in the Bible, love is not just an emotional thing. A strong element of the will in biblical love. You love the Lord, if you love the Lord as He loved you, and then you love others as He loved them, it's more than just a feeling. There'll be times when you will act in love, doing what's right toward the other person, even if you don't feel like it at that moment. So biblical love is not just emotional love. Listen, emotion is a strong element of biblical love, and we better not leave it out. I'm afraid many times we try to do that. To leave out love is to miss the personal element that ought to be at the very heart of our relationship to God. I was thinking this afternoon about one of the big examples in Genesis of somebody saying no in a very difficult situation, when Joseph said no to Potiphar's wife. Tempting situation? Yes, indeed. But he said no. And you remember what he said? How can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? I don't know about you, but I detect in that his decision to say no to that wasn't a purely intellectual, rational decision. He refused to sin against a God who meant something to him at the personal level. He had a personal affection for God that he was unwilling to violate. And that's what helped him say no, as much as the theoretical consideration that it would have been technically wrong to do what he did. Certainly in Paul's life, Acts chapter 20 and verse 24, for example, when he was on his way back to Jerusalem and people at every step along the way were saying, Paul, don't go down there, they'll kill you. Go down there, you're going to die. But he recognized that he needed to go, even if they did kill him. And he said in Acts 20 and 24, none of these things move me, nor do I count my life dear to myself, so that I may finish my race doing the right thing. Is that what he said? No. So that I may finish my race with joy and the ministry which I received from the Lord Jesus to testify to the gospel of the grace of God. Paul was motivated to give his life if necessary, to do the ultimately difficult thing, not just because it was right, but because he loved the Lord that was involved in that. And he would not be deprived of the joy of doing what pleased his Lord. And that's what made him the strong person that he was. I'll tell you, you just think about the people you've ever known who've made huge sacrifices. Who are those people? Why did they make those sacrifices? I bet you, without knowing the people that you're thinking about, they are people were motivated out of a love for some specific person or persons. It wasn't just sacrifice in the abstract, you know, serving some abstract cause. It was sacrifice that involved some specific people that they loved very much. Significant sacrifice almost always comes from real love for a real person. And if that person is God, then you've got the strongest motivating force in the world. And the thing that ought to most powerfully motivate us, both to say yes to the good things and to say no to the bad things, is the prospect of pleasing God. That's a powerfully positive emotion. 2 Corinthians 5, verse 9, Paul says, therefore, we make it our aim, whether present or absent, to be well-pleasing to Him. How much more positive could you be? How much more could you involve the emotions than to hear Paul saying, in effect, I do what I do, and I don't do what I don't do because I more than anything else want to do that which pleases my Father. It brings joy to His heart. And that is an emotional thing as well as an intellectual thing. So you've heard me say it before, we find ourselves with the ability to say no to certain things when there is burning in our hearts a much bigger and deeper yes. Word no needs to be said, but you'll find yourself able to say it when there's something positive that's important enough to you that you're not willing to give up that yes. And so you say no to this lesser thing, and you'll do it gladly because it pales in comparison to the importance of this yes that's burning in your heart. A lady named Evelyn Underhill said it this way, and I agree with this statement. She said, reason comes to the foot of the mountain. And it's the industrious will urged by the passionate heart which climbs the slope. I believe that's a good metaphor, a good way of putting it. Reason will tell you which mountain to climb, but it won't climb it. It's your will that'll have to climb it, and your will won't get to the top if it's not powered by passionate feeling. If that's a mountain you want to climb. You want that more than you want not to climb it. So reason will bring you to the foot of the mountain. Will will get you started up the slope, but ultimately will is going to give out if it's not powered by a passionate heart. To change the metaphor, think of a train going down a train track. Reason is the track. Reason will tell you which destination you need to be going to, which track to be on. Will is the locomotive, but emotion is the fuel that keeps the locomotive going in the right direction. You've got to have all three, reason, will, and emotion. So God must be a God that we intensely love at the emotional as well as the rational level. Hebrews chapter 12, verses 1 and 2. Therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight. And here's some saying no that's involved. Let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Well, that sounds like a pretty grim prospect, doesn't it? Just grind it out. Just gut it out. Here's what's right, and so you get rid of the things that are weighing you down, and you just slog through it. Well, that's not the whole story, is it? Verse 2, he says, here's how this works. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. So we need to remember where it is that we're headed. We need to remember what it is that we wanted when we obeyed the gospel. And we need to remember how important that is to us. The devil can ever distract you from what it is that you most want. If he can ever delude you into thinking that that's not so important, this little trinket that I have that's right here and now, that's what you really want, then you'll take that bait if you let slip away from your mind this bigger burning yes that the devil would like you to forget about. If he gets you to forget about that, then he may persuade you that this little thing right here is something that you ought to say yes to. Your parents are probably like mine. When you were a teenager, when you went out the door, they'd say, remember who you are. Well, that's important. But we need to also remember what it is we want. Remember what you want most. Don't ever let the devil distract you from what it is that you want to say yes to. And that yes, if you keep that burning brightly in the middle of your mind, will cause you to say no to anything that's inconsistent with that yes. I don't care what it is. So, we're back to the introduction, aren't we? Somebody got the slides out of order. Tell you. Let's see if the conclusion is anywhere. There it is. We fight a losing battle if we don't do what we talked about this morning, and that is remembering what our first love is. When the Lord wrote to the people in Ephesus about the fact that they had left their first love, he wanted them to go back and start doing their first works. There's no way they would do that until they first of all returned to their first love. They returned to that first love, then they'd want to do the first works because they'd love the Lord like they did back then. So we'll have the strength to say no when we can genuinely say what David said in Psalm 40, I delight to do your will, O my God, and your law is within my heart. It takes a lifetime of growing toward the Lord to be able to say that honestly. We get to the point where we can say that honestly, then the devil's not going to be able to do much with us. I delight to do your will, O my God, and your law is within my heart. You ever get to the point where you sincerely think that way and that's real for you, I'll tell you, to a large extent, the devil will quit picking on you and go try to find somebody who's easier to tempt. The devil is industrious, but he's pretty much of a coward. He flees from those who show any real strength of defiance against him. So you start thinking that way. You delight to do the Lord's will, and I'll guarantee you, the devil will probably try to find somebody who's easier to deal with than you are. May God help us to be able to say no because we remember what it is that we want to say yes to. And that is we want to show our gratitude to him for the forgiveness that is extended to us and for the hope that he's endowed us with of eternal life. May we never forget those things. If there's some way that we can be of assistance to you now as we close this lesson and this service and we sing our invitation hymn, if you are here and you would care to come to the front of the auditorium and let us know in what ways scripturally we can be of assistance to you, it'd be our honor to do that. Won't you come while we stand and sing the invitation song?
Yield not to temptation, for you'll be missing. Each victory will help you.